Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Okay, great. Well, so we are in the penultimate session of working the way through the Gospels. So I don't know how many you guys have been to, but we have done 12 this year. Well, we will have done by next week, which I realise means there are about 15 hours worth of me waffling on the Gospels available to download, which is quite a lot. Hopefully some of it is helpful. Today we are going to look at the theme of Jesus' death, which is a hint that we're getting towards the end of the Gospels, I think. And Chris is going to really help us with that, and he's going to teach some of the material. And then next week we'll look at the resurrection, so we end on a happy note. And Andy Tuck will carry most of that teaching as well. Andy Tuck, who's currently walking out. Oh, no, he's going to shut the doors. That's wonderful. Great, thank you. I won't berate you then. So today we're going to look at the death of Jesus, and Chris is going to tee us up with some group work, and we'll get thinking about some of that, and then we'll come back and end with some sort of devotional stuff and just really think about how it affects us. But it strikes me that when we think about the death of Jesus and we ask, why did Jesus die, it's very easy to leap to a whole load of things which, of course, are incredibly important, but are not really what I want to tackle today. So all the way through this series, one of my primary aims has been not only to explore interesting themes, but to help you to understand how the Gospels and the Gospel writers deal with those particular themes. And my aim really is not that you will go away feeling like I now know everything there is to know about the death of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, etc., etc., but rather you'll have tools to be able to read the Gospels in their context. You'll be able to go back and look at a passage and understand how you can get from that passage to the wider meaning, the deeper meaning, all those sorts of things. So part of my aim really today is that we will focus on what the Gospels tell us about the death of Jesus. And so there'll be all sorts of stuff that we won't really get into, which of course I think is incredibly important. So what the death of Jesus means for me, what Paul made of the cross, how the early church preached the cross, all these sorts of things, incredibly important, but they're not going to be what we'll focus on today. We also really won't focus on the mechanics of the cross too much, as in what was crucifixion literally like, how was it viewed in the ancient world, some incredibly interesting stuff we could look at there, but actually what I want us to focus on is really the intention behind the cross, some of the historical reasons for why Jesus died, and then towards the end we'll broaden that out to mean to sort of look at, well, what does that actually mean for us? And we'll give some hints towards some of the theological development that took place as people thought about the cross. But first of all, I just want us to think about what really happened, why did it happen, what were the intentions behind it, and then eventually, what does this mean for us? Why did it become such a significant event? So Chris is going to teach the first bit, but any questions or any sort of burning things that you'd just like to throw out there, get off your chest at the beginning? Great, wonderful. Keep those questions until Chris is up here and I'm down there, and then you can raise them. I don't know how many of you know Chris. Chris Bull has been in the church for how many years now?
Almost 10 years.
He predates me and many of us here, I'm sure. And it's great to have Chris here. I think this is the first time, certainly, he's taught with me in a Theology Matters seminar, so I'm really excited to see how he delivers the stuff today. He has a background in classics, so ask him lots of really difficult historical questions that I can't really answer. He may have some answers to those, or he may not, and may not thank me for saying that. But why don't we give him a round of applause and welcome.
Well, afternoon, everyone. Can I just add my welcome to Liam's? It's great to be with you this afternoon. My name's Chris. I love the fact that actually we can just come on a Sunday afternoon and just really dive into God's Word, go deeper than perhaps we would on a Sunday morning or a Sunday afternoon. So we're going to do that today, as Liam said, particularly looking at some of the motivations behind why was Jesus killed, why was he crucified. I guess one other encouragement for me is it's just, as we get into a lot of the material, and there are a number of verses and passages that we'll be looking at, I would just bear in mind that our heart is not that you would just go away knowing more facts or knowing some more complex issues, but actually this is God's word. God's word's living, it's active, it's useful for teaching, it's useful for training in righteousness, and actually we want God's word to get into your hearts as we go through this material. So we hope that you do learn something new. Please ask questions as we go, but we also hope that God really just speaks into your heart, and that as we look at this, that you would just be all the more amazed at what Jesus has done. If anything you take away, anything today, take away that what Jesus has done for you is incredible. And as we get into some of the complexities, I think that will be all the more amazing to you. So, with that said, what I'm going to be looking at are sort of three key areas. And it's on the first page of your handout if you've got that, so do look at that. We're going to be looking at the Roman charge, the Jewish charge, and Jesus' intention. And for the first two of those, so the Roman charge and the Jewish charge, we'd like to do that in group work. Liam mentioned that we want you guys to really start getting into God's word yourself, and there'll be a real sort of practical application of that. So can I split us into two? And maybe if we draw a line down the middle here, this side could be group one, this side could be group two. So group one, I'd like you to particularly look at the Roman charge. So if you've got Bibles, particularly looking at the passages in Matthew 27, in Luke 23, that are listed here on the handout. So have a read through those and have a think as you're reading through those gospel accounts. What motivations can you see from the Roman perspective as to why Jesus should be killed or why Jesus was crucified? And we'll have a think on that, we'll come back and we'll debrief and we'll look into some of those issues in more detail. So for group two, could you do the same exercise but for the Jewish charge? So looking at Matthew 26, John 2 and Mark 14. We're going to take the next 10 or 15 minutes to do this. So don't worry if you don't get to all the passages, that's absolutely fine. What we'd rather you do is in groups, maybe in threes or fours, just read through these passages together. You know, chuck around some ideas about what you think are the specific intentions from the Roman side and the Jewish side. And then in 10, 15 minutes, I'll come back and we'll go through these points in some more detail. Great. So let's go do that now. So I hope you find that helpful, being able just to dive into the text and to talk amongst yourselves about some possible ideas. So if we can look at the Roman charge first, just a bit of background then for the second group who didn't read those verses. What these verses were particularly looking at was Jesus being brought before Pilate. So the chief priests and elders had wanted to put Jesus to death, and so they'd handed Jesus over to Pilate, and Pilate was the governor and prefect under Emperor Tiberius at this time. In order for Jesus to be condemned and killed, they did need to go through Pilate. But interestingly, in the passages that were read, there was Pilate himself could find no direct evidence to convict Jesus, which is a very interesting premise then to start this discussion. So with that all said, what motivations or reasons did you find in the passages that you read from a Roman perspective to crucify and kill Jesus?
The main one we came up with was that the Jews were saying that he was king, and in Roman history, if anyone tried to usurp the throne, you know, they were put to death. So the fact that he was saying that the Jews were saying he was king would make him over Caesar, and that didn't fly.
Mm.
Quite a lot of peer pressure.
Sorry, missed that.
There's quite a lot of peer pressure. So at one point, particularly in John, when Pilate's listening to Jesus, he starts to have quite a healthy fear in terms of, there's something extra going on here. As Jesus speaks, he kind of starts to respond to Jesus. But there's a fear of what the Jews are going to do, what the Jews are going to say, how he will be made to look in this situation. Particularly, we decided that the linchpin was, you are no friend of Caesar's if you do not crucify this man. And that for him seemed to, because it says, you know, he tried to, from this point he tried to release him, and then suddenly say that, and then he's like, okay, fine, kill him.
Yeah.
So. I don't think it's so much fear pressure, it's fear pressure.
Fear pressure? Fear from on Pilate's side?
Yeah, I mean from the Jews and from the fact that he could lose his job.
Hmm. So interesting. So a few ideas there. So maybe if I touch on the first one, we can go through some of them. So the first one was, you said that Jesus was set up as a king, as someone who's sort of directly opposed to Caesar. So I guess maybe looking back to Liam's first talk, if you can remember all that way back in the first season, about the sort of the context of Roman rule at this time. In particular, this is a period that's called known as sort of the Pax Romana. That's a Latin term, and it means Roman peace. And peace is actually a bit of a misnomer if you know anything about the Roman Empire at this time, because really what it was a sort of at the height of the Roman Empire, which stretched all the way from Britain, all the way to Judea, Africa, throughout Europe. There were no major power struggles at this time, so the Roman borders were, I guess, more secure. But as you can imagine, trying to keep that sort of empire under control from Rome is a challenge. And the way that the Romans would do it is they would use the legions to go and secure borders or to pacify areas that were not under their control. So it was a very, they used their military to enforce this peace. So it was Rome's rule and no other. So obviously at this time, Judea is under Roman rule. So it's very interesting that you mention that Jesus is then set up as a king to oppose Caesar, because that would then suggest that there's something under threat, that this area perhaps isn't secure. So maybe taking that point and building on the other point, which was sort of fear from Pilate's side, what do you think would happen? I'd be interested to get your thoughts if perhaps word of this got out beyond this trial, that there's this new king of the Jews who's here.
Mm. Sarah, you know, looking last week at what happened in about AD 17, the destruction of the temple, and I think Pilate's working quite hard to make sure that doesn't happen. There's already groups of people trying to rebel. Jesus was actually seen as one of those. So there's already a lot of a lot of kind of low-lying rebellion going on.
I think the other group saw one group kind of rise a bit, they would join in and say, oh, well, they did it, and they're a small band of people, surely we can do the same. And World War One would really start way back then.
In the passage that you read, did you see any evidence that Jesus was set up as a king, or was, I guess, sort of inciting panic or causing fear amongst the people?
Not in what we read, but in knowing some of the previous passages that come before that, you know, like when the taxes come up, one of the things he was accused of, well, he's not paying taxes. Mm-hmm. We know that, you know, Jesus said, render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. So, you know, he was saying if it belongs to Caesar, give it back to him. That he was still being set up kind of as the patsy while he's saying don't pay your taxes. But he wasn't saying that at all.
Yeah.
And then when Pilate actually questioned him, the question wasn't, are you a king? It's, are you the king of the Jews? Yeah. And so he's like, it's, as you said, I came to be king of the Jews.
And actually, the king, the idea of the Messiah coming as king was always going to be a physical, like, beating down the enemies with a sword. And so when that you have this kind of thing with Jesus being king and prophet at the same time, prophet being the one that suffers, king being the one that triumphs, and they were all hoping that he'd come and be a king and beat down Roman rule. So the fact that he's heard this term, the king of the Jews, probably does mean that's really the only clue I'd say we have in the passages that this was already happening.
Yeah, and it's the first question that Pilate asks to Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? Which I think to me suggests that's probably the issue that's at the front of his mind, that this Jesus character could be sort of rising up in rebellion against him and therefore against Roman rule as well. Which
Jesus didn't consider himself the king.
No.
I mean, they ask, are you the king? He says, you say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born was to come into this world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me. So he didn't consider himself the king.
No.
Yeah, it's kind of like a catch-22. He neither confirms nor denies, you know?
Or at least if he does confirm it, he doesn't want to confirm what they thought of kingship.
Yeah, but their idea of kingship.
You could kind of read it like he's saying, well, yes, I am, but he didn't want to say, yes, I subscribe to your view of kingship.
Fine
so,
king.
Yeah, exactly. So,
you know, to be a king, a physical king or whatever, you don't necessarily have to testify to the truth. Whereas he was born to testify to the truth.
And then building on that, I think it was mentioned, there was a verse in Luke 23, verse 2, and it said this: "We found this man," referring to Jesus, "misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." So this is in Luke's account of this trial. And what was different, I thought, here, as well as the issue on the king, which we've discussed, was it's almost this idea that Jesus is stopping us being Roman citizens, which I thought was particularly interesting if we think that Luke himself is a Gentile author as well. So it's more than just Jesus opposing Caesar or opposing Pilate. But actually, looking into it, is this the Jewish people saying, no, Jesus is stopping us doing our civic duty and paying taxes to Caesar as well. So there's more at stake than just a threat. It's a way of a life as well. So I thought that was particularly interesting to pull out. What about sort of Pilate's own motivations beyond just there being sort of issues with Jesus being this king character? Was there anything else that you saw?
He actually believes in that. I mean, he says numerous times, "I find no guilt in him. There's no reason to crucify him." And then as we get into the story, you know, the Jews start accusing him, "Well, if you don't crucify him, we're going to tell Caesar on you." And he's like, and he's a Galilean? Oh, I'll send him to Herod.
Yeah.
Kind of passes the buck.
Mm. Absolutely. That passage with Herod, I thought, was fascinating, because you're right. Once he realizes that Jesus is under the jurisdiction of Herod, he passes responsibility to Herod. But actually, if you carry on reading to the end of that section, you then see the fact that actually there was enmity between Herod and Pilate. But actually, in resolving this issue with Jesus, that enmity disappears and they become friends. Yeah. So another thought perhaps could be, is this a political maneuver of Pilate using Jesus to his own ends? So I thought that was interesting as well. But you're right, it does certainly suggest that he is passing the buck. He's not wanting to take the brunt of, all of the sort of the riot and the uprising that's happening at the moment. That was definitely interesting.
In the Matthew passage, Pilate's wife comes to him and says, "I had this dream last night. It made me physically sick."
Yeah.
"Don't, you know, get rid of this guy. Do whatever you have to do. Don't deal with him."
And but then the interesting thing with that omen was that he ignores his wife.
Yeah,
why do you think he might ignore his wife? A life lesson there. But I think given that we sort of know that Roman culture is very superstitious, I found it particularly interesting that his wife gets this dream and this omen, which he then tells the Pilate, but Pilate then just ignores that. Mm. What did that sort of suggest to you?
She has no authority.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Presence of Jesus, people reveal their idols, and for him it's power and control, and everything that he's trying to do is, and there is a moment of crisis where he almost relinquishes power and control in the face of Jesus, but this idol of, I need to keep control, I need to listen to the people that I'm trying to subdue, I need to make sure there's not a riot, to make sure any threats to Caesar and therefore my authority are quashed, that kind of overrules even his superstition. You know, clearly the superstitious gods of Rome were not his gods.
Yes.
Power was his god instead.
And I think that's absolutely spot on from my perspective. Because if you look then at verse 24 in the Matthew passage, it goes on to say, Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, and that a riot was beginning. And then sort of from that interest method, he just hands Jesus over. So I think you're right. He hears the omen, he ignores it, because he realizes that actually, from his own perspective, I'm losing control here, and this is going to reflect on me, so I need to hand over Jesus or hand him over to be crucified.
The thing I find interesting in the Herod passage is actually looked forward to meeting Jesus, who wanted to see some signs and wonders and miracles. And, you know, so there's this a little bit of awe and mystery to this man that who is being claimed as king of the Jews.
Mm.
And he was, you know, anticipating meeting him, and Jesus gives him nothing.
And I guess last thing from me then, perhaps, in this session, is what did you think about then how Barabbas fits into this, the motivations there?
I think from my own personal view, I'd want to know, is this the only other guy that's in jail? Because a known murderer, as opposed to a guy who's just got a few claims that can't be proven, doesn't really seem a fair trade-off. How'd they come up with that guy's name in the first place?
They probably knew he was coming back.
No, you're right. So Barabbas was convicted of robbery, insurrection, and murder, and was sentenced to be crucified. So very interesting that Pilate offers Barabbas in Jesus' place, saying, who do you want to crucify? This person you know who is doing all these things that you're accusing Jesus of, yet there's no evidence of that. Do you want to free him, or do you want to free the man that you are trumping up charges on for insurrection, rioting, opposing Caesar?
He's actually providing them a way out of, you know, the kind of trouble they've gotten themselves into, but they refuse to take the help.
Possibly seeing how much they hate Jesus.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Here is this terrible criminal who's killed people and made you all look bad, and here's Jesus. Which one do you hate the most? And clearly they hated Jesus the most at that moment. Mm. So kind of probably gave him a bit of a litmus test of, okay, they really hate this guy if they think that Barabbas is better.
I'm kind of, you know, sometimes confused about that. Because Jesus Christ is Jewish, and his people, actually, you're supposed to protect him, your brother, your sisters, and it's totally, you know, I don't really get it. Why?
And I think that's a brilliant question, and actually one we're going to ask the second group when we look at the Jewish charges. Is that right? So if we just pause on that one for just now. Sorry, yes.
Because looking at the whole passage, right, the idea that I get is this. The woman's charge is actually based on the Jewish charge, whereby the day that is mentioned in the Bible is going to be the religious leaders who brought Jesus to Rome to be charged by Pilate under the Roman charge so that they can crucify him, that they can sentence him to death. But you read through everything, Pilate doesn't say that he has anything that he wants to charge him with. When you look through everything, he has done nothing wrong in the Roman law. But it's only according to the Pharisees that he has done something wrong that requires him to be charged under the Roman law so that he can die. Or else, the Jewish side or the religious side, they are not allowed to crucify or to kill anyone under their law. So, in a way to say it's the law that's practiced over the land and the cultural law over individual nations, they are different, and they are not allowed to give corporate punishment for the Jewish law. So. The religious leader came together and bring Jesus to Rome, charge him, and they say things according to what they want to say. So like not paying tax and stuff, it's all being brought across by the religious leaders, but it was not because of the citizens. Then at night they went out and incite the citizens and say, this is what Jesus told, blah 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 blah, and therefore you guys should crucify Jesus instead of us.
Yeah, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think you're right. When you read through these passages, if you take it from a sort of a Roman perspective, what Roman laws has Jesus broken? I think the answer is none. Pilate can't find any evidence. What he can find, and what he does hear, is that riots are ensuing, that Jesus is being portrayed as this opponent to Caesar, that actually he's stopping them being Roman citizens based on these trumped-up charges, and then actually the Jewish sort of chief priests and leaders then start inciting the crowd to put further pressure on Pilate. So it's almost like the people who want Jesus to be crucified know what it's going to take to get Pilate to bow to that pressure, and that they are, it's a very deliberate plan. But I think you're right that when you consider it from a Roman law perspective, those charges are sort of empty.
I mean, the way I think, and we should get on to the Jewish charge because I think this will weave some of it together, but the way I would see it is, like, firstly to say, when we think about the cross, we very often just leap to what does the cross mean for me, and we don't often stop and think about the historical background, which is why some of this is just so fascinating to do. I think it's really complex, and that's the main thing that I take from it, that there is no clear reason why Jesus was put to death. The Romans couldn't find a charge, the Jewish people couldn't really find a charge, they all sort of fought against each other. You get the Jewish people bringing them into the Roman court and being sent back. And so they just seem to be trying to grab anything they possibly can to have Jesus put to death. And it's not very clear why it happened. But I think it must be somehow linked to what they thought Jesus and his followers were capable of. Because it wasn't just, has Jesus done anything that makes us think let's put him to death? It was more like, what are the people going to do when they think this is the guy who's leading us and we're following him? Is it going to lead to a large crowd of Jewish followers rising up against Rome? In which case, putting one person to death, even though we can't quite find any reasons why, may stop a large mass of people revolting. And I think that might have been, is the hypothetical crowd, was part of their fear that other people may follow him, this may lead to something bigger. And there's an interesting verse which isn't in here actually, but in John, just after the John 11 or 12, I think it was John, just after the raising of Lazarus, the priests talk about what to do, and they decide they're going to put Jesus to death. And they utter this line, which in one sense is just like a fairly normal line, but John hints at like they prophesied and they didn't even know it. And the line is, it will be better to put one man to death for the sake of many. And there's this hint that, well, if we put this one man to death, then many other people will be spared because the revolution won't start. And of course, what John draws us to is that the Holy Spirit was speaking through them, and that Jesus literally was dying in the place of many. And so I think there's that kind of crowd dynamic as well. The reason for putting Jesus to death was to stop something bigger that involved Jesus' followers. And so the Romans and the Jews together, they just tried to pin anything on him, and the fact that they couldn't, and yet still put him to death in order to keep the peace is quite horrifying. Yeah, it did. But I think once we put the Jewish bit in, that will hopefully tie it all together.
That's great. So thank you very much for your suggestion. I thought that was great. Group two, Jewish charge. So a bit of context. So Jesus has just been betrayed by Judas. He's been seized and brought before the chief priests and elders who were seeking false testimony against him. So what did you guys come up with? Yeah, I think that's a great two things that you pulled out there. So if we take the temple first, you're right. So what it says in Matthew 26:60, the claim against Jesus is, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. Contrast that with Mark 14:58, which says, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. So that's very interesting straight off the bat. That seems to be two different accounts of a similar situation. Did you manage to read the verse in John 2 about what Jesus actually said?
Yeah.
What did you think of that? And then the charge that was brought against them.
I'm happy to open that up to the group.
You said you smashed it. You said you smashed it. You haven't even read it.
That's all right. So in John 2:19, what he says is, when they are asking for a sign, Jesus answers, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. So the reason I say all three verses out that one after the other is for you to begin to appreciate what's actually going on here. So Jesus' words are very much being twisted and taken out of context. It's like the Jewish people before the council jumped on his words and thought, this is something we can use against him, because we know from reading the Gospels that they're looking to find a way to incriminate Jesus. And when they heard him say this, and what he was actually doing was referring about his physical body, like you mentioned, actually thought, no, this is Jesus threatening to destroy the temple that took 40-odd years to build. Actually, we can use that and incriminate him. So I thought that was very interesting, that the sort of the twisting of the words that was going on there. And then I think your second point, you mentioned sort of Jesus being accused of blaspheming. I completely agree with that. When you read through sort of Matthew 26 and Mark 14, they're asking questions like, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? If you are the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus isn't refuting those claims, but nor does he directly answer them either. But they're trying to bring up this charge of blasphemy, that actually Jesus is saying he's God when they believe he's not. And therefore, under sort of the Old Testament law, that would enable them to put Jesus to death. But more so than that, and Liam, I don't know if you want to touch on your sort of the Son of Man reference here that you would have spotted, because that was particularly important as well.
Yeah, so one of the things that we looked at last week, if you were here, was we talked a lot about the phrase, the Son of Man. Who was here last week? Do you remember this? So, and we said it earlier in the series, actually. When we read the phrase Son of God, it's very tempting for us to think second person of the Trinity, because Father, Son, Holy Spirit. But actually, we've looked at, through at various points in this series, the fact that the Son of God is actually just a technical term for Messiah. And so if you go back to 2 Samuel 7, for example, David is promised that a son would come from him, and God would be like a father to this son, and this king would raise up a kingdom that would never end. And so the phrase Son of God literally just means Messiah, really. It doesn't have necessarily the divine overtones that we think of when we hear that phrase. However, this phrase Son of Man, which we looked at last week, definitely does. So if you remember, the Son of Man in Daniel 7 comes into the courtroom, and he comes on the clouds of heaven, which is a symbolic way of saying he comes with power and authority, and all the beasts end up worshipping him, which is something you do of a god, right? Not a king. So the phrase Son of Man actually ideally, strangely, has more of a sense of divinity than Son of God does. And so I find it fascinating that when Jesus is asked, are you the Son of God, or the Son of the Blessed, the Son of the Most High, in other words, being, are you the Messiah, Jesus says, I am, and you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. He refers back to Daniel 7 again. So he's asked, in essence, are you the Messiah? And he says, yes, but don't have too small a view of what the Messiah is. I am the Messiah, and you will see me coming on the clouds of heaven. And at that point, the high priest goes, we don't need to have this conversation anymore. You've heard the blasphemy. And so Jesus takes the kind of the charge, are you the Messiah? He essentially says, yes, but I'm a bigger Messiah than you had ever thought, because I'm also this divine figure that's coming, and justice will be done. I will be vindicated, etc., etc. So I think it's at that point it turns from, I mean, the high priest just wrings his hands, and you know at that point, yeah, if Jesus is not who he claims to be, then he has grounds for that charge of blasphemy. Of course, we believe that he is the Son of Man, and so therefore it's not blasphemous. But for me, that's a real turning point in the passage.
Okay, so kind of an offhanded question. First of all, when did the Pharisees start looking for, like, how soon into Jesus' ministry did they start looking for things that they could kind of bring against him? And then were the only things really that mattered were these taxes and that he's claiming to be a king?
As if you knew the timing.
Well, any... there are various points in the Gospels that we've looked at that where it says, and the people looked for a way to kill him or to put him to death. So it'd be a whole load of things. For example, the end of the parable of the tenants. So Jesus tells a story and they want to kill him, which is not not great, is it? But they realise that Jesus has said these things about them. And at that point, which is only a couple of weeks before, or just a really short period before he's put to death, they're already deciding they want to kill him. We get the story in the raising of Lazarus, where the people decide we want to put him to death. There were other points where people tried to stone him, and then he was miraculously rescued. And so over that 3-year period, I'm sure there were many, many points. I would argue that it really came to a head around the temple stuff, because when Jesus turned over the temple tables and said the stuff that we looked at last week in Mark 13 and Luke 21 and Matthew 24, you kind of get the sense that, oh, now he's finally said the right things, so that they're able to go, we can use that. Mm-hmm. And even then they have to twist it incredibly. But it's like, I think that hatred had been bubbling up over many years, and finally in his last weeks Jesus gave the people the reasons or the opportunities or phrases they could twist to use in their agenda. Does that make sense?
Great. any other points from the second group?
Don't you think, because the way Jesus Christ was born, where he was born, it wasn't like Moses, do you think that would have been one of the reasons of the Jewish function?
So the question is that Jesus wasn't like Moses.
Yes. I mean, in terms of where he was born, the family he was born into, and how he came into, because the Jewish people, you know, they actually recognized the power of Moses at the time in the Old Testament, and they were still expecting their Messiah, but, you know, but because his birth, Jesus Christ, you know, and the way he was born and so on and so forth, then, no, he couldn't be, you know, we don't think this is the king, this is our Messiah. Do you think that could have been the reason, one of the reasons that, you know, they want you
Well, I think my answer to that would sort of Liam already alluded to, which is we know that from the Old Testament, Messiah was prophesied to come. And obviously then that was fulfilled in Jesus. But you're right, certainly these chief priests and the others who are accusing that don't believe that Jesus is the fulfillment of that Old Testament prophecy. So I think you're right in saying that when Jesus starts saying things like Son of God, Son of Man, that's definitely very incriminating to him from their perspective, because they're coming from a place where they don't believe that to be true. So, like you said, I would say that definitely, because they believe that, when they hear these words, they're not thinking on sort of evidence that they've seen in Jesus' life. They're actually going, no, this is you blaspheming. This is you leading us away from God, and therefore we want to...
But I think the only thing I would add to that is that, actually, if you look at Matthew and Luke and the birth stories, they do make a point that Jesus' lineage actually does go back through David. Oh. And so he had a legitimate right to the throne. And so in a sense, the birth stories may make you think all the more, oh, this guy could be the Messiah. But you're right, that both in the birth, but then all the way through his life, he just challenged people's expectations. So they always expected, as someone, I think it might be you said already, a warrior king, or a king who would lead in a particular way. And when just time and time again, he disappointed him over 33 years, I think that must have all... sort of chipped away at it together. So.
And there is a moment in Acts, isn't there, where a lot of the priests all come to faith in one foul hit, because they suddenly see all of the things lining up and they go, oh, he was the Messiah, and now we've got all the proof we need that he was. But I think it's one of those things where their expectations of what the Messiah should be had got warped.
Yeah.
They didn't really want to be examined in the way that God said they, you know, like the Messiah was coming to, like, you heard the thing about the stumbling block and all these things, you know, they didn't want that, because they'd actually got quite comfortable in the way that they were dealing with the law.
Yeah.
And that they didn't want to be tested.
Let's add in the third element, which is Jesus himself.
Yes. So thank you, God. I would think just before we sort of jump into Jesus' intention, I think the key here is that there's an awful lot that's going on in these passages. There's a number of different, I think, historical, political issues, as well as sort of theological that we've just touched on, at stake. So there's a lot of complexities around this. And then on top of that, there's obviously Jesus' intention himself. So could I get some volunteers to help me read out some verses? So if you're on the handout, there's three from John. So it's John 10, 17 to 18. John 18, 4 to 8, and John 19, verse 11. Could I get anyone to read it? There? Thanks, Andy.
It says, the reason my Father loves me is that I lay my life down, only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father.
Brilliant, thank you. And then John 18, verses 4 to 8.
Jesus, knowing all things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. So when he asked them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Therefore he asked again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these go their way."
Brilliant. Thank you. And lastly, John 19:11.
Jesus answered, "You have no power over me if it is not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of the greatest sin."
Brilliant. Thanks very much. I wonder what you noticed just in sort of listening to those passages as they were read out. We've talked about sort of the pressure of the situation that Jesus was under. Yet, when I read these passages, it strikes me that Jesus is a man in control of the situation, that actually he is making sure events are happening as they should, which I find quite remarkable if I think about the uproar with the trial of Pilate or all the false accusations that were coming from the council that we read about. Now, this is Jesus saying to Judas when he comes to betray him, "No, do what you came to do." When we the passage in John 10 says, "But I lay it down of my own accord," referring to his life, "this charge I have received from the Father." And then John 18, then Jesus, knowing all that would happen, came forward and said. So it just, when you read these verses, you realize that Jesus is in control, which I think is particularly amazing. I think the John 18 passage is particularly interesting because I don't know if you heard the phrase, "I am he," that Jesus responded to you. I don't know if you heard how many times that got said by Jesus. It got said 3 times. "I am he, I am he, I am he." Jesus is not trying to escape. He's not trying to get out of the fact that he is about to be arrested and go to trial. But no, he's actually saying, "Do you know what? No, I am he. I am the one you are looking for." He's not getting out of it. But then, very interesting, obviously, then parallels what happened with Peter and the 3 times denial of Christ later on. So again, it's just this very interesting crossover between different parts of the Gospels that shows that there's more going on here. This isn't just happening by chance. No, this is Jesus knowing where he is going and making sure that that happens. I thought the other interesting thing was obviously the John 19 verse with Pilate, where it says, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had given you from above." You know, when we saw the trial with Pilate earlier, Jesus kept silent most of the time. But actually, then when he had conversation with Pilate, he opens up. And actually, what he's saying here to Pilate is that actually, "Pilate, no, you're not in control of the situation. You don't have authority over me. That's been given to you by my Father in heaven. And this is happening as it should." And I found that particularly interesting, that that's when Jesus speaks. That's when Jesus speaks. So I thought that was particularly interesting. And I then try and put my own self in that situation. How would I react? Because I think if I knew that I was subject to this horrendous punishment, which was crucifixion, that what we've talked about is a punishment reserved for revolutionaries. It was the most shameful and most painful death that there was in the known world at this time. And it was so bad that it wasn't given to Roman citizens because it was deemed so shameful. If I knew that that's where I was heading, why would I not be doing everything to get out of that? That would be my case. So when people are going, "Are you Jesus?" Well, a bit like Peter, I'd probably say no, and or try and find a way to get out of the question and get it away. Or if I'm with Pilate, why would I not be using that opportunity to say, "Actually, no, I've not done any of these things," and plead my case and try and get out of that punishment? But no, not Jesus. He doesn't do any of that. I think it's so amazing when you read it to go, actually, I can't believe he's reacting like this in this situation, knowing where he is going. I think that shows Jesus having just, I guess, having this plan, knowing the plan of what his Father is trying to do. And I say that because if you look at John 5:19, it says this: "The Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing." So in that instance, what Jesus is referring to is obviously is miracles that he is performing. But actually, if I take a step back and trying to understand sort of the big picture of the Gospels, which is, why did Jesus come? He came here to die and rise again so that we may come into relationship with the Father, then I would put to you that all of those reactions that we saw Jesus make in those verses are going to be driven by the fact that he knows his Father has a plan for salvation for the world, and that involves him, and it involves him going to the cross, and nothing is going to take him away from that course of action. So I find that quite remarkable that Jesus sort of knows this and goes, no, this is why I'm responding, which is obviously then a challenge for us in our own lives. You know, are we listening to the Father and guidance? Are we running away from situations, or actually are we ourselves looking to God's word? Are we ourselves not wanting to run away when we shouldn't? I think the writer to the Hebrews helps us understand this further. Hebrews 12:2 says, Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising its shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. I find that choice of wording incredible. The joy set before him. Jesus knew the pain, the punishment, the death that was coming, yet could see beyond that, could see the joy of the people of God being redeemed, the joy of him having this beautiful bride where one day we will all be together in heaven with him. Jesus saw beyond that, and that shaped his life, that shaped his ministry. And then the last thing I just wanted to share with you on this was from Luke chapter 22 and the Garden of Gethsemane. This is just before Jesus would be arrested. He went to the Mount of Olives to pray, and he said this, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. He's talking about the judgment that's to come. He says, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. I think it wasn't just enough for Jesus to know the plan. Jesus had to live the plan. Jesus had to go through the pain for the joy set before him. I find this one of the most incredible moments, and almost one of the most human moments, because if you read the passage, you'd see Jesus sweating drops of blood, just the intense stress that he is under because he knows what is coming at the cross. Yet, even in this moment, he's able to say, do you know what? If you can take this away from me, Father, do, but not my will, but yours be done. Jesus knew what his death would accomplish, and because of his love for you and for me, he said, not my will, but yours be done. It's one of the most moving statements, and one of the verses that I think that us as Christians that we should never treat lightly. I know many of you will know this story very well and some of the material we've covered today, but I think it's incredibly important to get to the heart of this, that actually this is the greatest demonstration of love that we've ever seen, that Jesus said, not my will, but yours be done, going to the cross in our place. And so I would say, what was Jesus' motivation? I would say that Jesus knew the Father's plan for salvation. He knew the fact that by going to the cross and rising again, he would finish and deal with sin and death. And he also loved us so much that he was willing to give up his life. So I think those are the things that I'd love us just to keep hold of today. Brilliant. Liam.
Give him a round of applause.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, so I hope that has shown, really, thank you, that the events leading to the death of Jesus were complex, and there were loads of different angles on it, loads of different motivations that led it there. But as Chris sort of ended with that final bit there, God orchestrated it. God knew. And he did it because he loved us. And all the things that he had said about coming to be a ransom for many, for the forgiveness of sins. He knew that was coming through the cross. And I don't know how much of his life Jesus was aware of what was coming, but the fact that he, at this moment, which just must have been agonizing, he went through with it for us is mind-blowing, really. It's absolutely incredible. And what I want to do, just finally, I was kind of struggling to know really how to end this session, really, because there are so many different things we could look at. I thought it would be good just to look at one of the accounts of the death of Jesus and just draw out a couple of things that I just find really beautiful about it. So if you happen to have a Bible, turn to Matthew chapter 27. And I mean, really, there are loads of different things we could look at, but I just want to draw out a couple of, I suppose, ironies about this particular passage. And I suppose some of the stuff we've been looking at really has been kind of historical, really. What are the historical reasons for Jesus' death? And I suppose now I want to move to just think a little bit more theologically, a little bit more personally, because obviously we don't just treat this as an abstract thing that happened. It has very real meaning for those of us who would consider ourselves followers of Jesus. So I want to just look at Matthew 27 and draw out a couple of ironies. And actually, if we just back up a little bit and start back with the bit that we've already looked at, Barabbas. I find the story of Barabbas so powerful because really it's the story of all of us to some degree. Someone who deserved death, who had charges brought against them, really deserved them, gets freed because someone who didn't deserve them at all stands in our place. And I think Barabbas, I cannot imagine what it must have been like to be in the sandals of Barabbas and literally experience that. But he has experienced what is true of all of us. There was a charge against him that he deserved. He was known as a robber, a thief, a revolutionary. He literally deserved to die. And crucifixion, as Chris has said, was a form of death so horrific, it was kept for those people, not for anyone else, for those people, the lowest of the low. And he was in that place, the chief of all sinners, as Paul said about himself. And yet literally the Son of God stepped in his place and he walked free. And I don't know what happened to Barabbas. I don't know if he walked away and carried on being a robber and a thief and a swindler, but I imagine it was a life-changing moment where he gets to know, I actually walk free as this man in whom there is no wrong dies in my place. And there's an irony there, I think, because his very name, Barabbas, it means son of the father. Bar Abba, son of the father. And so you get this incredible moment where this guy who in name is the son of the father, but in practice is an enemy, gets replaced by the true son of the father who dies in his place. And I think Matthew writes that and mentions his name. I think if you knew the language, you knew the names, you would go, wow, that's incredible. I cannot imagine how moved Barabbas would have been. I find that moving. And I think this introduces a little section that is riddled with irony. So on the next page of the notes, I've spelt out four ironies of the cross. These are only four. There could be many, many more. But here are just four things that I find beautiful about Matthew 27 and about the cross. And this is adapted from a book by D.A. Carson called Scandalous. You may want to read the whole chapter, but just four thoughts that I find beautiful. And the first is this, that at the cross, the one who is mocked as the king actually is the king. So Matthew 27, I mean, look at verses 27 to 30. The soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters and they gathered the whole battalion before him. This is probably around 600 people, 600 soldiers gathered around Jesus, which is quite remarkable to summon that number of people to inflict this act of cruelty upon one innocent person. But 600 people, roughly, they stripped him, they put a scarlet robe on him, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head, and they put a reed in his right hand, and kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail the King of the Jews." I mean, this is just incredible mockery. So they strip him of his clothes and they dress him up as if he is a king that they don't actually think he is. And they give him all these things, this scarlet robe, which is something that a king would have worn, scarlet and purple, very royal, regal, expensive colours. And so they're dressing him up like a king. They put a reed in his hand, which actually, if you look at any of the old Roman coinage, the reed was the symbol of Caesar's rule. They are putting this crown on his head that's got thorns in, which were probably 15 to 20 centimetres long. These are huge, huge thorns being rammed onto his head. They are mocking him as this kind of would-be king. And this really, I mean, it's pretty horrible when you think of it like that, but it reminds me of the sort of barracks humour that you see. And when you find out about the way people are abused in places like Guantanamo Bay or equivalents where detainees have been mocked and beaten and tortured and humiliated, it sort of gives you a slight insight into what happened to Jesus. These people try and put him through the most severe humiliation they can, mocking him as if he was the king. And it carries on. They have this scepter, which they then beat him with repeatedly, spitting at him. And they exclaim, "Hail, King of the Jews." And actually they mean precisely the opposite, because they want to show him, you are about as far from being a king as you could possibly be. And then what do they put on the plaque above his head? They write that he is the King of the Jews. Again, they don't mean it, but the irony of it is that we know with hindsight he is the very thing they thought he was as far away from being as he could possibly be. And when we think forward to other passages of scripture like Philippians 2, we know that one day every knee will bow to this king, and those knees will bow to this king who they mocked, they ridiculed. There's a deep irony in this passage. The one who they mock for being a king really is the king. Second irony is this. The one who is utterly powerless is completely powerful. And we've touched on that a little bit already with what Chris shared. But just look at verse 32 onwards. As they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. So Jesus is just too weak to carry his own cross. And here Matthew just, in various different ways, emphasizes the weakness and the great need of Jesus. Someone else has to carry the cross for him. He's been so beaten and is so worn as a result. Verse 35, they divide his clothes by casting lots. So Jesus is crucified naked. He literally doesn't have any clothing on. There can be barely anything more shameful. He is completely degraded and shown to be weak before everyone. Passers-by mock him. Verse 40, they say, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So people mock him for being entirely powerless to do the very thing that they thought he had claimed to do. And yet here there is an incredible irony, because all the people who mocked him failed to recognize that in this moment Jesus was actually doing the very thing he claimed. His body, which is the temple, was being destroyed and it would be raised again. So the people considered it a sign of powerlessness that Jesus, if you are the Son of God, they said, come down from the cross. And when he didn't do it, they looked at him and said, he is utterly powerless. I would put it to you that they have got a wrong definition of power, because it takes more power to stay on the cross than it does to come down. And so at this moment where Jesus is shown to be the weakest, he can't carry his own cross, he's completely naked and shamed before the world, and everyone mocks him, at that moment he is showing more power, more self-control, more commitment to the cause than anyone has ever done or could ever do. The second irony of the cross, the one who is utterly powerless is powerful. Third irony, the one who couldn't save himself saved others. If you look at verse 41, the chief priests, the scribes and the elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel, let him come down now from the cross and then we'll believe him." They mock him and they say, surely if you are actually the Son of God, why can't you save yourself? And the fact that Jesus doesn't come down from the cross confirms in their mind that he really isn't the person he claimed to be. He cannot save himself. They mock him. And yet, knowing what we know about Jesus' mission, his plan, the fact that he deliberately laid his life down, the fact that he came to give his life as a ransom for many, the fact that he came to be the Passover lamb, means that actually if Jesus had saved himself, he couldn't have saved others. It is in the very act of not saving himself that Jesus saved others. And if Jesus had done the thing that the people asked him to do, to come down from the cross, save yourself, the entire mission would have been over. He would not have saved anyone at all. And so we see this third irony of the cross, that Jesus has come so that his blood will bring the new covenant, the forgiveness for many, the restoration that people had longed for. The one who couldn't save himself saved others. The fourth irony is this. The one who cries out in despair trusts God. Verse 43. The people mock him. They say, "He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, I am the Son of God." So the people mock Jesus and they say, "He trusts in God. Well, let's see if his trust is going to be vindicated, if it's going to be proved to be worthwhile. Will God rescue him? And the implication seems to be, well, if God rescues him from the cross, then the trust is not in vain. The very fact that God does not intervene and allow Jesus down from the cross seems to say that Jesus' trust is entirely in vain and has been put in the wrong place. The robbers who are with him also mock him in the same way. And so when Jesus cries out in verse 46, my God, why have you forsaken me? That seems to the bystanders, to the Jewish people in particular who've been mocking him, like they were right all along. This guy trusts in God. Let's see what happens. What happens? God deserts him. Even Jesus himself seems to utter this cry of despair. It seems like at this moment, even Jesus has realized that God has deserted him. And yet, if you recognize that phrase and you look back to Psalm 22, you realize that Jesus is not actually crying out in despair at all. What he is crying there is the greatest declaration of trust one could ever cry out. If you've got the Bible, turn to Psalm 22. And one of the things I've said time and time again throughout this series is whenever you find something referenced in the New Testament and you go back and look at how it came about in the Old Testament, don't just look at the verse, look at the whole thing. Because in referring to a verse, the writer or Jesus himself may well be referring to a wider context, a greater story, and have a big point to make. And I think that's exactly what happens in Psalm 22. Because this passage, which starts out with despair, is so full of hope. And the whole psalm, if you read it through, it sort of oscillates between hope and despair, hope and worry at present circumstances. It starts off, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. And so it begins with this sense of despair that Jesus alludes to. But verse 3, yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. I think when Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? That is not just despair. I think he's alluding to this whole psalm. Because Jesus, despite saying, God, everything seems to be against me, he is, I think, also able to say, yet you are holy. And all throughout history, you have always rescued your people. When Jesus cries out, he is actually reminding himself of the whole of this psalm, in which God has been shown to be constantly, permanently faithful to his people. Verses 6 to 7, we don't have time to look at it in full, but I'm a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind, despised by people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Almost an exact parallel to what was said of Jesus. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. Again, it just feels like this is so richly describing the agony of Jesus. And yet, again, it oscillates from despair to hope. Yet, you are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breasts. On you I was cast from my birth, and so on and so on. And in the same way that the psalmist starts off by saying, life is awful, it feels like God has abandoned me, and then goes, but God has never abandoned his people. Therefore I draw hope from that. Again, he goes, people mock me. People say, God has abandoned you. And yet, I know God has never abandoned me. From day one, I've been utterly dependent on him. And he's shown himself to be faithful. Again, I think this whole psalm is in the mind of Jesus. So when he cries out and it seems like despair, it's actually a strong statement of trust. Verse 12 onwards, bulls encompass me, strong people surround me, they open their mouths at me like a ravening, roaring lion. I'm poured out like water, all my bones are out of joint, my heart is like wax, it is melted within my breast. You hear that and you think, at the cross, that psalm has never been more true than the moment where Jesus' heart melts like wax. His bones are literally out of joint. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. He couldn't even carry the cross far enough. His strength had so departed. My tongue sticks to my jaws. He's thirsty. Jesus says, I thirst. This psalm just so evocative of what Jesus was going through. I can count all my bones. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I have no idea what was going on in the mind of the psalmist when he wrote this, because crucifixion did not even exist at the time when he wrote this psalm. And yet it so beautifully, poetically describes what literally happened to Jesus. His hands and his feet were pierced. They stare, they gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Exactly what has happened to Jesus. But you, O Lord, do not be far off. O you, my help, come quickly to my aid. Deliver my soul from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dog. Save me from the mouth of the lion. You have rescued me from the horns of the wild oxen. I will tell your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. And you get this incredible switch that Jesus, at his worst moment, experiencing all of this, suddenly goes, but I think there is a future to this story. I will yet tell of your glory to my brothers. And it goes back to that Hebrews verse, which Chris sort of finished with, really. For the joy set before him, for this idea of future nations and people being able to worship this God, Jesus endured the cross. Verse 27, all the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord. All the families of the nations shall worship before you. For kingship belongs to the Lord, and he rules over all the nations. It carries on, and look at verse 31. They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn. He has done it. He has done it. It is finished. I think this is all in Jesus' mind. And the deepest irony of all is at the moment where it seems like he is utterly, utterly defeated, and the cross being like the biggest show of shame and power that the Romans had at their disposal. At that moment, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And everyone around must have thought, there we go. Even he's realized God has now forsaken him. No, Jesus is appealing to this whole psalm, knowing there is still a future. He has done it. And he cries out, it is finished. And the only reason that we are able to stand here today and sing and worship and have this freedom that we know is because Jesus stayed on the cross. And the irony is that at the moment where he looked entirely powerless, he was entirely powerful. The fact that he didn't save himself means that he could save us. The fact that he was mocked as king strangely points to the fact that he is king, and one day every knee will bow to him. And the fact that he didn't despair, the fact that he didn't give up hope in God, but he kept that hope in God, means that we now, these brothers from another nation, get to worship, get to be brought into this family. I find that absolutely incredible. And I think it helps us just to move from the historical to the theological, to realize that it was a complex web of reasons why Jesus died. And you can look at this, and I can recommend some books that will help you to understand what happened on the different days and all that sort of stuff. But really, when you move from the historical to thinking, what did Jesus intend? And why did Jesus cry out these things? And what does this mean for us now? It means it's just so beautiful, so rich, that the King of Heaven can work through the hands and decisions of evil people to bring rescue and salvation for us. And that blows me away. So I think really that's probably the best place to end today. And on the final page, there's something else we were going to look at, but I think we'll just end there. Maybe you might want to read this quote in your own time. It's a quote by N.T. Wright. It's pretty dense in places, a bit hard going, but he kind of tries to sum up a lot of what we've looked at throughout this whole series. I'll leave that with you, and you can figure it out as you go. But I think that's a great place to end. Jesus is incredible. And he has managed to achieve, through the most gruesome and unexpected of means, the most amazing freedom for us. And if you take nothing away from these 15 hours of waffling that have come from me so far, but that, I think that's worth the entire thing. So thank you very much for coming today. Next week, Andy Tuck is going to look at the resurrection. And again, we'll just see how that fits within Jesus' overall plan, within the greater story of Scripture. And I think it will help us to look at the resurrection in slightly unusual and different ways that maybe we're not used to as well. So I think that'll be a great session and a great way to end. And then actually just one final thing to say is this. We're trying to figure out how to do Theology Matters in the future, given the move to four services. We're not entirely sure what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And with people going to different services and that sort of stuff, it's going to be a bit of a logistical challenge. Where do you do it? How do we draw the most number of people? What do we cover? Those sorts of things. We've got a couple of ideas. But if you have any thoughts or things that you think, I'd really love to cover that, or I've really liked this, but maybe we could do a different format, any thoughts like that, do email me, liam@christchurchlondon.org, or catch me on a Sunday. I'd love to hear from you so that we can continue to create something that is hopefully helpful for us and those who tune in on the podcast as well. So, otherwise, let's leave it there. Have a great afternoon, and I hope to see you again next week.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.